Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode number 34 of the Beyond the Ring with Big T Wrestling Podcast. I'm your host, Big T, here with you tonight. And I have a very special guest that is with me on the phone line right here, right now, to join us for this very special episode. He is a legend in the professional wrestling business. One of the best to lace up a pair of boots. We got Mr. Patriot here with us tonight, and I'm so honored. Thank you, Del, for coming on the show tonight.
Yeah, me looking forward to it.
We're going to have a fun time tonight, and I guess we'll take the fans, you know, on a walk through memory lane, so to speak. And I guess where I'd like to start this interview with you is, you know, I've done my studying. I've learned a lot about you. I know you played football before you started your wrestling career, well, college football, and then, your career through WCW, Japan, WWE. So let's start off with the beginning. Now,
well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Now, with the beginning, what I wanted to ask you, because I know you started off with college football, what was your first love in life? Was it pro wrestling, or was it football, or was it both? Like, how did everything come about? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I've always been a sports junkie. I still am to this day. And I grew up in the South where college football is king. I grew up in Columbia, South Carolina, so obviously the University of South Carolina football here. But also too, pro wrestling was a huge part of my life. I went to my first live show when I was 10 years old, at the Township Auditorium in Columbia, South Carolina. And obviously fell in love with pro wrestling at an early age, before the age of 10. But I would probably say in the early years, football was a bigger, was a bigger deal to me than pro wrestling was. I ate, drank, slept, Gamecock football, pro football. I could give you the roster for most of my favorite teams. I could tell you where most of the players on those favorite teams. I played college football. I devoured sports. And I would say football was my first love. Second, there's not a big gap between the two.
Well, let's start off with football, since that was the first thing, that you did. I know you played for the Gamecocks, and years of your college football career, and did you get to play any play in any bowl games or win any national titles when you were playing football back in the day?
To the University of South Carolina in 1980, and as a true freshman was a backup offensive guard, and I was very, very fortunate that my freshman year, one of my teammates, a guy by the name of George Rogers, won the Heisman Trophy. So that was a very special way to start off my career, having the opportunity to block for, be a teammate with, be a friend of, a guy that won a Heisman Trophy, and still to this day, one of the greatest football players I've ever been around. And, you fast forward for the next couple of years, that 80 team was followed by a couple of mediocre years. 1984, which turned out to be my senior year. We had a very special year. That was the first time a team that won 10 games in school history. At one point, we were 9-0. We were ranked second in the nation. The number one team in the nation, that was Nebraska. They got beat by Oklahoma that day. We had gone to Navy to play a very good Navy team. We knew that Nebraska had gotten beat by Oklahoma, so we had to beat Navy. We'd be the number one team in the country. We'd be 10-0, and we'd be playing for a national championship in the Orange Bowl. And we lost that day. So we come within an eyelash of playing for a national championship. that Navy defeat cost us that. We even at Team Two played in the Gator Bowl my freshman year. We also played in the Gator Bowl, so I played in two bowl games. And I was very fortunate my senior year at the University of South Carolina. I was voted most valuable player on that team, the first team to ever win 10 games in school history. I was voted team MVP, team captain, and a first-team consensus All-American. So it was a very special year, and it ended a very special 4 years for me at the University of South Carolina. I had a very brief NFL career. I signed at the free agent with the Tampa Bay Bucs in 85. They traded me to the Falcons in 86, and then the Falcons released me prior to the start of the 86 season. And that's when I was ready to shift this ball in my rearview mirror and then start pursuing a career as a professional wrestler. So I was ready to put football to bed at that point and try to become a pro. That was the next step for me.
Amazing, amazing story, you know, about your football career. It sounds like you had a very decorated college football career and, you know, sounds like a great period in your life. Now, ready to put football in the rearview mirror. And when you made that decision, how did I know you said wrestling was a close second love, you know, in your life at the time. So once football was in your rearview mirror, I'm assuming that's when you decided, let's try to do professional wrestling. And then I'm assuming, obviously, well, of course you did that. And then how did you go about training? You know, what did you look into? Who was your trainer? How did you get started and get going on this wonderful journey in the wrestling business?
Well, immediately after the Falcons released me, I came back to Columbia and actually to America. I went to work for a company in Columbia in sales. I had a pretty decent job. I had a, you know, my own company vehicle and clients that I called on. But I was just unhappy doing that. I was still a young guy. I still wanted to be very athletic. I still felt like I had something I needed to do athletically. And much love for wrestling. So there was a school in my hometown, Columbia, South Carolina, that was owned and operated. Changed in pro wrestling history, at least from a female perspective, and it was owned and operated by Lillian Ellison, the fabulous Moolah. And so I paid my money and off I went to school at Moolah's. And it was geared more toward girls. There really had never been a guy that had come out of that school that had had really any success. There'd been an awful lot of girls that had come out of that school that had great careers. But she had some guys around there that were really just guys that she would send up to do TV for events. It's what they used to call job guys or enhancement guys. And that was the role of these guys. They would work weekend shows that Louisville would have around South Carolina, in the Midlands of South Carolina. And those guys probably didn't know a whole lot more than I did, but they could at least teach me the basics, how to lock up, how to snatch a headlock, how to grab an arm bar, how to take an arm drag, how to deliver an arm drag. So they could teach me the very basic fundamentals of the business. I was very fortunate that one of the shows that she ran here in Columbia, she brought in Wahoo McDaniel, who had a home in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Wahoo was working on that show. It was actually in a converted skating rink. There may have been 200 people in the building, but I met Wahoo that night. And that was a very important move for me, a very important night for me, because Wahoo took an immediate liking to me and sort of took me under his wing. And from there on, I was really tutored and mentored by Walker for the next several years. And that was just invaluable to be able to travel with Wahoo and be able to run the roads with Wahoo. And he made sure wherever he got booked, I got booked. And so I probably got more training and more knowledge from him than I did in Louisville school. But that was the infancy of my career.
Wahoo McDaniel, what a name and what a legend to learn from. That is absolutely unbelievable. Wahoo McDaniel, he, you know, he was one of the greatest, and just to hear that you got to work with him, that is unbelievable, Dell.
We have that football background in common, and I tell you, it doesn't matter whether you played for South Carolina or Oklahoma like Wahoo did. There's just that brotherhood, that fraternity of guys that played at that level, played in the NFL, and there's just this special bond you have. And it's a tough sport. It's a very violent sport. It's a very physical sport, a very tough sport. I think there's just a bond that you
gotta say, Dell, you obviously did a very great job at doing so because, like I said when I introduced you, you have one of the most decorated careers in the wrestling business. And, you know, to go forward with that, after you trained with Wahoo and, you know, you start getting your feet wet, you start getting into the wrestling business. I don't know if you can remember back this far because, I'm sure this will be a long way now. If you remember offhand, who was your first ever match against, and what did it feel like getting in the ring for the first time in front of a crowd doing something that you love so much?
Well, my first match was in Hampton, South Carolina, in the sort of maybe 100 people, but it was one of the littlest matches. And I had a buddy of mine that went to the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina. He and I broke into the business together, Ed Mullis together. And so that was our first match as a tag team. Mullis decided to put mask on us and called us the mask. And we worked just a couple of guys in the helped train us. I think a guy named Johnny C, and I can't remember the other kid, but that was my first time in a ring. And, you know, I can say that I wasn't nervous, I wasn't scared, I was anxious, I was eager. I was so excited. I played in front of 80,000, 90,000. I went to Michigan and played when I was in South Carolina. We went to Michigan and played. 105,000 people, so I had played in front of a huge crowd before of about being intimidated, they didn't scare me, didn't bother me. And even though there were only maybe 100 people there that night, I wasn't excited as I'd have been working at Madison Square Garden because this was my first step in the journey with me, you know, my little wrestling career. But I can remember it very vividly. It was a hot summer night, and there was no air conditioning. We had 10 days in it, and I was sweat like a pig, but I was loving it. I was officially a professional wrestler.
And that had to feel so good, especially when it's something that you love with all your heart, and with Wahoo McDaniel, and now next thing you know, you're in the ring, you know, starting everything off, and I can just imagine the great feeling because just hearing the story itself is making me feel good right now.
Well, it was. I'll tell you, it's I pity anybody that's gone through life and they've never had a dream or a goal that they can pursue. And I was fortunate. I had two of them in my life. I was determined. I was going to play football at the University of South Carolina. Not only did I get to, you know, I remember as one of the greatest players in school history, only one of four contemporary All-Americans that played at the University of South Carolina. And also, too, to have a dream of becoming a pro wrestler, journey that entailed. And again, if anybody has gone through life and they've not had something they were passionate about, not had a dream, not had a goal, that was literally burning a hole in their gut, then you really missed out on life. And I was very fortunate. I had two of them. and was able to achieve success in both. And it was very special night that first night I stepped in the ring, man. It was a big deal. I could barely sleep the night before, just thinking that the next time I was going to be in front of a crowd of people inside that ring for something.
And I'm sure there had to be no other feeling like it.
Nope. You know, I've told a lot of people, and sometimes people look at me sort of wrinkle their nose, that the chase and the journey of becoming a star in that business was actually more fulfilling than actually becoming a star. I mean, that was the most fun part about my career. I think in that journey and that chase, of hoping that one day you can not only wrestle in front of 100 people, maybe one day wrestle on TV, and maybe one day wrestle in Madison Square Garden. And I think the journey was actually probably the most fun part of
it. You know what? It definitely sounds like it. And I'm just trying to take my experiences too, you know, even though they're different, just trying to take my experiences and, you know, taking what you're saying and really thinking about it, and you know, now it's like the journey of getting there, you know, to get there, and, you know, it's fun. It's fun to do, and then you finally get there, and you start doing things, and you realize you're doing what you love to do. There's no better feeling. And,
no, it's not.
And I gotta tell you, even though I'm not a performer, it's one of my biggest and greatest loves in life as well. Wrestling is the first thing I fell in love with as a kid. And, you know, I never look back on it. Once I fell in love with it, it's always been my favorite thing in the world, and it still is till this day.
Well, I've been very fortunate. This year was actually my 30th year of being involved in professional wrestling and having it play such a huge part of my life. It's still a big part of my life. It makes a personal appearance. Yeah, so this is being involved in it. Well, I've never regretted
the year. 30 years, 3 decades. That is absolutely just incredible. It just to hear you say that 30 years, 3 decades is absolutely just an incredible feat. And I guess where I want to move next. You know, when you first went pro, where did you start off in your pro career? Was it in Japan and then from Japan to WCW, if I'm not mistaken?
No, actually, it started for me. Wahoo, when he came to Columbia and worked at the show that night for Moolah, he had a permanent home in Charlotte, North Carolina, but he was actually living in Minneapolis, working for Frank Gagne in the AWA. When he got back to Minneapolis, Greg Gagne, and those were the guys that were running the AWA at the time, he told me about this big kid from South Carolina that he had met on one of Moolah's shows. He told me he was actually home for a few weeks, and while he was home in Charlotte, Moolah had booked him on that show. That was my first stop. My buddy that went to the Citadel that broke into the business with me, he and I went up and actually started working for Vern. And business was very poor at the time. The AWA was really sort of on a downhill dissension, and it wasn't the company it worked for then. So business was very good. We worked there about 6 months. And we came home for Christmas. The AWA wasn't going to run any shows for about 6 weeks to 2 months. So I then went to the Mid-South territory and worked for Jerry Lawler there in Mid-South. And I spent about 2 months there. They took me into the business and they hired me I needed to probably to do something else to work for a career and something else. He up and wanted me to come back up to Minneapolis and work for him again. And this was my second time working for Vern. And at that time, that's when Vern and Glenn came up with the idea of the Trooper. And that was really my first probably big break. It was my first time being exposed to TV audience because the AWA was on ESPN. Monday through Friday from 4 to 5 o'clock. And, so that was my first big break, my first opportunity to be able to work to a nationwide audience was the second time I worked for Vern when I was working as a trooper.
I remember some AWA shows from back in the day because I remember when they would air the shows on ESPN Classic. It was like a few years back when they were doing it and I remember some of the AWA shows and you know, it just amazes me to hear, you know, how, Jerry Jarrett and all the guys in Mid-South, you know, they basically told you go do something else and Vern taking you back. I'm so glad that Vern gave you a shot because he's seen that potential of a wrestling legend in you and, he let it shine. And going forward in AWA, what was the rest of your time like in AWA when you finally got that big break as the Trooper? Where did you go from there?
Again, the AWA was just, you know, it was no longer a viable financial success. It was just a TV, a few spot shows here and there, but it was all basically just TV. I would fly up on weekend and do our TV tapings and in Rochester, Minnesota. We did a few at the Showboat in Las Vegas, but that got to be too expensive, so Vern, in a cost-cutting effort, just started filming the shows there right outside of Minneapolis. And it was good. It helped me. It helped me gain a lot of experience. I got to work with guys like Larry Zbysko and Sergeant Slaughter and Walsh. And of course, there was a mix of young talent there as well that was up and coming. And myself and DJ Peterson, we were the very last tag team champions in the history of the AWA. We were the last guys to hold those belts before the AWA went out of business. And shortly after that, DJ lost his life in a motorcycle accident. But it gave me nationwide exposure. And, it gave me an opportunity for other doors to open for me. I met Eric Bischoff there. Eric was our TV guy. He did our commentary for our TV shows. He was our play-by-play guy, so to speak. So, I got to know Eric and, I got to know, of course, Greg very well and Jesse Ventura worked there as well. I was part of the company as well. So those guys were very instrumental in me later on down the road going to work for WCW. But Eric was later on put in charge of WCW. But before that, I worked in Japan. I did one tour for All Japan as the Trooper, and it wasn't a very successful tour for me. I mean, the business itself, All Japan was doing phenomenal business. But I just wasn't prepared for the style and the type of matches, the fast-paced, long, drawn-out matches with 30 false finishes. I didn't do very well, so I thought I had really blown my opportunity to work for Baba. And, but later on down the road, that would come back around and I would have another opportunity to work for him. But, after the AWA folded, I was very fortunate. And, that an upstart company called the Global Wrestling Federation ended up with that same time spot on ESPN that the AWA had Monday through Friday from 4 to 5 o'clock. And I was contacted by the guys that were the powers to be at Global, Bill Eady, Joe Pedicino, and we were going to do all of our TV tapings for Global at the Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas, and they sent me a ticket to fly out for the very first TV taping for Global, and they told me nothing different, so I went out with my Trooper gear. I figured that's how they were going to use me. And literally about 5 hours before our very first TV taping for Global, we were all staying at the same hotel there in Dallas, the Rogueway Inn. I got a call from Bill Eden. He said, hey, man, he said, I'm in Joe Pedicino's room. He said, I need you to come over here. We got an idea. We want to run past you. And, of course, Joe and Bonnie Blackstone are husband and wife, and they were part of the brain trust there at Global along with Bill Eby. And I walked into the room, and they set me down. And we had just, to give you a quick backdrop on the reason they thought this would be a good idea, our military was involved in the war in Iraq, where Iraq had gone into Kuwait and occupied Kuwait. And President Bush had sent our troops into Kuwait to liberate Kuwait. And patriotism was just at an unbelievably high level. And they said, look, man, they said, we can capture this patriotism that's running through the country right now. And we've got an idea. And it's a character called the Patriot. And we think you're the guy to pull it off. And they had brought a costume box for them. Bonnie Blackstone pulled out this red, white, and blue mask, red, white, and blue tights, and red, white, and blue trunks. And they said, we think you're the guy that can pull this off. And if it works, we think we can actually build this company around you and make you the face of the Global Wrestling Federation. Right. The first time that character had ever been seen, I walked down the aisles of the sportatorium, and that building erupted. Man, I'm telling you. Crazy. And I knew then that we were on to something good, and that took my career to a completely different level.
And you know what? I'm just thinking about it, you know, Dallas, Texas, the Sportatorium, one of the most, you know, historic places to have pro wrestling back in the day. And for you to debut the Patriot character, which is so legendary as of today, and in one of the biggest American cities of Dallas, Texas. Yeah, when you said that building erupted, I could only imagine. I'm surprised the Sportatorium was able to keep its roof on.
Well, I tell you, they definitely lifted the roof that night. And it was just such good timing. What was going on all around the world with our military and the way the American people, you know, were behind our military and President Bush and the love for, you know, what we were doing. And to Dallas being a very special place to do it in, and the special building. You also think of, you know, that's where President Kennedy was assassinated. So when you lump all that together, I'm getting chill bumps just telling you about it. That night, there was no doubt in my mind that we were on to something good with that character, and it really took off that night.
So once this character got a heart, the Patriot gets a hot start, and, you know, the crowd gets a good response, you're hitting the ground running. What's next for you, you know, going forward? I'm assuming that that they had to have you in line for a pretty big push, you know, for you to hit the ground running as hot as you did and for the crowd to respond as well as they did.
They did. As a matter of fact, they put the TV belt on me, and then just a few weeks later, they put the North American Heavyweight belt on me, which was their top belt. And so I held both belts at one time. I later vacated that TV belt and kept the North American Heavyweight belt. And we did it in a very, an angle that probably doesn't get enough credit, a big-time babyface angle. I beat Al Perez. It was a tournament. It was Al Perez line, the finals, for the belt. And, I got the 1-2-3 over Al, but his foot was on the rope. The referee didn't see it. I did. They rang the bell and raised my hand and put the belt on my shoulder. But I gave it back in a big baby face move because the Patriot wasn't going to take the belt under those circumstances, even though the referee didn't see it. I saw it, the people saw it, that Al's foot was on the bottom rope. So that led to a rematch with Al and I. And I beat him fair and square in the middle of the ring, 1-2-3, to become the North American Heavyweight title champ for a second time. And they were really pushing the dog out of me. But unfortunately, with Global, while it was a great, great thing, it was a well put together thing, a well thought out thing, to try to be a third company to compete with WCW and the WWF at the time. It was an unbelievable roster of talent there with young up-and-coming guys. I was there. Marcus Backle was the Hanson Stranger, the Harlem Heat, as Ebony Express. Then he had a great mixture of just veterans that had already established names for themselves. It takes a lot of money to run a company like that and to pay for TV time. And Global just could not compete financially with WCW in the WWF. And we began to struggle financially. And I sort of saw the handwriting on the wall. And that opportunity, I thought I would never get again, the opportunity to go back to Japan and work for All Japan and Mr. Baba, greatest promoter ever, it presented itself again. Baba sent word through Jimmy Suzuki, who was a guy that worked for the Japanese magazines as a photographer, but also worked as a talent agent for Baba here in the States. He sent word through Jimmy that he wanted me to come back and work as a Patriot. So I was going for a three-week tour. I didn't have any intentions of never coming back and working for Global again. Just going for a three-week tour in June for Mr. Baba, but two nights into the tour, he approached me, and obviously I had gotten better in the ring, and my work rate was better. I just had more presence about me, more charisma, and in a character that was just on fire. With the Patriot, and my second night in, he said, look, I want you to work full-time for me and exclusively for me. And, there that night, you couldn't knock me over. That chance to get to work for him again, which I never thought I would get, it presented itself. And so I contacted the guys at Global and told them that, you know, unfortunately I wouldn't be back. Thanked them for the opportunity. Thanked them for what they had done for my career. But I felt like that this was a great opportunity for me to work for Baba full time. And they were very gracious. Lee and Bonnie Blackstone were very gracious and very supportive of me going to Japan and working for Baba again. So that was my next step.
I'll tell you, it's such an incredible journey. Hear this story. And one question that I've had for, you know, all of my, well, some of my guests that have wrestled in Japan, I always ask them, what is the difference wrestling in Japan and the wrestling here in America? Is there a big difference to you? Is there a certain style that you prefer better? You know, how are the fans, you know, down there? Like, what are the differences? Is it like stepping into a whole nother world once you touch down on Japanese soil and wrestle?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's still basic pro wrestling. You know, you get in the ring and you know, you do the things that you have to do. And the biggest difference was, Mr. Baba was doing unbelievable business. I was fortunate that I worked for every major company in business basically during my career. And I was in WCW when they brought Hogan in, and I was in the WWF when the Attitude Era started. Business blew up, but All Japan, there was nothing that could match the business Baba was doing when I worked for him. And it was a very simple but a very successful way of doing business. TV show was 1 hour a week on Sunday night that came on and broadcast all over Japan. There were no promos. There were no interviews. Everything we did consisted of a match with a clean finish. A 1-2-3 finish every single night. There were no outside interferences. There were no countouts. There were no disqualifications or double DQs or anything like that. It was all based on action in the ring, the believability, what was going on in the ring, and it was just phenomenal. So it in itself, it had to be a more believable style. So therefore, it lent itself to a more stiff style, a more snug style. It was a lot more physical. It was tougher on the body. It probably took a few years off my career because my body had serious injuries working in Japan. that later cost me my career, but it was different in that way. And that it was just a completely different style of business. It was all about the action in the ring, the believability of it. And therefore, it lent itself to an unbelievable roster. I've never worked on a company anywhere that from top to bottom had the depth of talent that All Japan had when I worked there. It was unbelievable.
Some of the guys that you went up against in some of your favorite matches out there in All Japan?
Well, on the American bus was Stan Hansen, myself, Johnny Ace, who later became my tag team partner, John Laurinaitis, the Can-Am Express, one of the most underrated tag teams I think ever, Doug Furness and Danny Crawford, Terry Gordy, Steve Williams, Abdul the Butcher, the Fantastics, Jackie Fulton, who later became my tag team partner in Japan as the Eagle. It was just phenomenal. The talent that was on that bus, Dory Funk, Andre the Giant, Japanese bus, and of course you've got Mr. Baba. You've got what I think the greatest worker I've ever worked with, Kobashi. You've got Misawa, Kawada, Kawe, Jumbo Tsuruta. Dude, that's Hall of Fame talent there on both buses, both the American and Japanese side. It was just phenomenal, the business we did, the type of matches, the work rate, second to none. The highlight of my career, hands down, was the time I spent in All Japan. And some of my most memorable matches, some of my most fun matches were working with Kobashi as my tag team partner, working against Kobashi, working with Jackie Fulton as my tag team partner, working some phenomenal matches against Terry Gordy and Steve Williams, against Danny Crawford and Doug Furness at Can-Am Express, getting to know and working with Andre, working against him in tag matches, working with him in tag matches. It's just highlight after highlight, working with Dory, Abdullah, working with Baba, working with Stan Hansen, becoming friends with all those guys. It was just phenomenal. Phenomenal business, a phenomenal mind that Baba had, an unbelievable way of doing business, and it was just a great time to be there.
And you're absolutely right. You know, between the American bus and the Japanese bus, I mean, you are talking Hall of Fame talent on both buses.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
It's interesting that you brought up the name Doug Furness, because I was just watching Survivor Series 1997 the other day, and I remember Doug Furness was in a Survivor Series elimination tag match, and I just remember hearing stories about Doug Furness and how strong Doug really was, and what a great physical specimen that Doug Furness was. Did you ever get to share the ring with him?
Absolutely. Gosh, I guess I probably worked hundreds of matches against Doug and Phil. You know, I've been fortunate to develop some wonderful friendships, and guys just truly love. You have that brotherhood. Marcus Bagwell's one of them. I mean, I can name many. But the closest friend I ever had in the wrestling business was Doug. Doug and I were like brothers. I mean, throughout the years I worked in Japan, wherever you saw Doug, you saw Dale, and wherever you saw Dale, you saw Doug. We trained together, we ate together, we worked the movies together, every night Doug would come to my room and literally, we'd set up 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning talking life, talking family, talking politics, talking sports, talking football, talking wrestling. When Doug married Martha Furness, my wife at the time, we flew out to San Diego. I was Doug's best man. Doug and I it was the greatest friendship I ever had in that business. And I'm fortunate that I got to play football with and against some of the greatest athletes on the face of the earth, wrestle with and against some of the greatest athletes. But hands down, it's not even close. The greatest athlete I've ever been around was Doug. the things he could do, he could jump out of the building. But yet he was the strongest human being I've ever been around too. You know, Doug's one of the greatest shoot powerlifters ever. I mean, hands down, one of the greatest powerlifters ever. He was a rodeo guy when he was in high school. Played football at the University of Tennessee. A phenomenal athlete. And unfortunately, we lost Doug, you know, just a few years back. Way too young. He was suffering from Parkinson's disease. But without question, the greatest friendship I ever formed in that business was with Doug.
And I'll tell you, the few matches that I've got to see Doug wrestle in on WWE TV, he was definitely a phenomenal talent. And, you know, yeah, like you said, it's a shame that we did lose him a few years ago. And, you know, I was just thinking, actually, now that you were talking about Doug, and I was thinking, wow, when you were up there in the history and the friendship, you know, that you guys had when you were up in WWE, that would have been something phenomenal to see you guys get like a tag title run or something, the two of you.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, Doug and Phil's run wasn't very long in the WWE. You know, they were involved in a very horrible car crash, in a rental car, and both of them were injured. And had to take a lot of time off the road. And, you know, in the wrestling business, it's, you know, if you're not on TV for any length of time, and especially in a situation where they were just trying to get established there, they were one of the greatest tag teams on the face of the earth. But not many American people knew about them because they had spent their entire career in Japan, where, you know, the people in the States didn't get to see them. So they get their big break to come to work for Vince. And, you know, they're introducing to the American fan base and the American audience. And then they're in that bad car wreck where the both were hurt pretty severely and had to take time off the road. And unfortunately, in our business, out of sight, out of mind. And it just was horrible timing the way things worked out for them. And they never got to really develop into what they could have, you know, truly become there in the WWF. So, of course, the same thing happened to me with the injuries. It cut my time short, too, and cut my career short. But I just wish the American audience could have gotten to see Doug and Phil at their best, because Doug was a phenomenal athlete. Phil had a great mind for the business, and together they were a super tag team.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, for me, just seeing them for the little bit that I did back in 97 when they were there was just – they worked well together, and, you know, it's a shame that their time was cut short. But moving forward, in All Japan, now, you know, you're going hot in All Japan, you're working for Baba, and, you know, you're just tearing it up with the Patriot character. Now, what happened as far as, cause I know you had a brief stint in WCW as well after, 94, 95 when you were there, I believe.
I think it was, you know, sometimes it's hard to differentiate years. They all seem to run together, but, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Bischoff, at this point in time was in charge of WCW. We'd had a good relationship from our days in the AWA. And he called me up and said, "Hey, man, I need to fly you over to Atlanta and we'll sit down and talk about you coming to work here." And so I went to Atlanta that day and met him at his office at the CNN Center. And we spent about 3.5 hours behind closed doors and contract, a 3-year deal. And of course, I brought it home and had my attorney look it over and just felt like it was something I needed to think about for a couple of days, and I was glad to have the opportunity to come back to the States. I felt like my body probably needed a break from just that, you know, relentless physical style that we had in All Japan. And so I signed a 3-year deal with them, and of course, later they teamed me up with Bagwell, and we had the belts twice as tag team champs there. But about halfway through my 3-year deal, you know, they had the big coup with Hogan and taking him away from Vince. And, of course, all those that followed, the friends of Hogan. You know, they bring in Savage, they bring in Beefcake, they bring in Duggan, and you bring in Honky Tonk Man and Nasty Boys and all those guys that followed him. You know, went along with the whole focus of the company became Hogan and his buddies, and those of us that were already there and established in WCW were sort of put on the back burners, and you know, I just felt like that there were bigger and better things for me somewhere else. The opportunity to go back to Japan had presented itself. And, so I had 1 year left on my 3 year deal. And, I went to Eric, in what I thought was good faith, man to man, and said, Eric, I just feel like I'm just sort of spinning my wheels here. I know you guys have put the belts on Bagwell and I a couple of times, but that really wasn't the reason for me coming here, was to be mired in tag team competition. I think the world of Marcus, I think we've been good things as a tag team. But you know, it's just not what I want to do. And I've got the opportunity to go back to Japan. I've got an opportunity to go back and work for another company halfway around the world. Your TV is not seen here in the States. We're not competing with you. You're not going to be competing with us. Will you let me walk? Just let me out of that last year and, of that deal. And you wouldn't do it. And, I was gone anyway. So, later, I was supposed to be in a pay-per-view, I think, in Tupelo, Mississippi. And the only person I told that I was not going to be there and that I was done was my tag team partner, Marcus. I owed it to Marcus. We were very good friends, remain so till today. I think the world of him. And I owed it to Marcus to let him know what was going on. I said, but you'll never see me in another WCW ring, Marcus. I'm done. And I'm walking out of my last year. I'm heading to Japan. Of course, I was, you know, threatened with all kind of legal lawsuits and stuff like that by Bischoff and the cast of lawyers that ran WCW. But I figured if I ignored them, they would eventually go away, and they did. And so I was back in all Japan now for my second time there.
So now with all that going on, and I believe the pay-per-view that you walked away at, if I'm not mistaken, I believe was WCW Slamboree. If I'm not mistaken.
Do you know where it was at?
You know what? I'm trying to think back where it was at. I could,
not that matters, but I think you're right. And, you know, I had no-showed him. I felt like, look, I gave Bischoff the opportunity to cut me loose, release me. He didn't do it. I'm gone anyway. And so, yeah, I just never went back.
What was it like? Well, you know, I've heard a lot of different stories with Eric Bischoff as well over time. Like, I know he wouldn't, obviously, like we just talked about, he wouldn't let you out of your deal. I mean, what was it like doing business with Eric? I mean, do you feel that Eric was a good promoter, or was he someone that was just hard to get along with, and, you know, where he wanted things his way and he would always buck heads with his talents? Or, I mean, was he okay to deal with? Can you give a little insight about Eric Bischoff?
Well, you know, everybody has their own opinion of people they've worked with and worked for. And I've always based my opinion not on what somebody tells me about a person, but my experience and my relationship with that person. And I always got along with Eric. I found Eric to be easy to work for. I had no problems with him. The only issue I ever had was that one, you know, when I went to him and asked him to let me go and just to let me walk from that last year. And he didn't. And it wasn't a confrontational thing in any way, shape, or form. He was just getting me hurt. And he was going to hold me to that third and final year, and I knew in the back of my mind I was gone. But I always got along with Eric. And listen, I can't blame Eric. You know, Eric had an opportunity to sign Hulk Hogan and Savage and all those guys away from Vince. And put a big dent in Vince's, you know, list of talent and his roster. And, heck, man, do it. I don't blame him. And I don't know that I can blame him for then making the focus of his entire company about those guys. But there were other guys there besides the friends of Hogan that were good talent, good workers, good hands, that could get in a ring and perform, that could draw money. And those of us that weren't in that circle of Hogan's buddies were just sort of kicked to the curb. And I don't say that's good or bad on Eric's part. He did what he thought he had to do as the man in charge at WCW. And I did what I thought I had to do, what was best for Dale Wilkes' career. And that's plain and simple.
And you know what? That's the best thing you could do. You know, you have to do what's best for you and do what you feel is going to, you know, get you in the right places where you need to be. Now, after you left and you go back to Japan and you make a big return in All Japan, was it like a, did you have like a big welcoming back in there? Did was the crowd all happy to see you and, you know, ready for you to leave off, you know, like continue where you left off at?
Well, we actually were able to do it without the fans even knowing. We had, you know, I had flew through Jimmy Suzuki, the guy I was telling you about earlier, that was a talent agent for Baba here in the States. And the man that owned the travel agency that Baba used for the American talent, he was a Japanese man, but he lived in Los Angeles and had a travel agency there, a very successful travel agency. So through them, you know, we were able to broker this deal with Baba when I was coming back, but we kept it on the down low, and the fans really knew nothing about it. And that first night of that tour, you know, all of a sudden the Patriot came running back through the curtain, and Baba had even, they pushed me like crazy the first time, and I came back even in a better spot, more entrenched with that top group of Americans with Stan and Gordy and Williams and the top Japanese guys and Kibashi and Misawa, and actually went out and Kawada put me over in a match, and so it really even elevated me even more. And it was great to be back. I loved it there. Like I've said earlier, the highlight of my career is All Japan and being there. So it was good to be back home. It was the way I felt in Japan. And a style that I liked better, working with a company I liked better. But there was a bad side to it. And it was the physicality of our style of work there. It just started chipping away at my body. And I started having a couple of very severe injuries that would start affecting my career and eventually would cut my career short. So while I loved being back there, I loved working there. I loved working for Papa. I love the guys I work with, the style of work. You know, the one downside to it was just the physical nature of work. And, I probably did some things. I remember Hanson telling me one night, he said, dude, he said, I'd jump off the top turnbuckle with that Patriot missile. It looks good. You're a big guy. You're athletic as all get out. I mean, you can drop kick somebody in the top of their head. You can jump out of the ring. It all looks good. But I'm telling you, as a big guy, if you keep doing it, it's going to cut your career short. And he was right. It did. It eventually cost me my career. So that was the only downside. Or the only negative thing I would say about working in All Japan was that second time in, it literally started in a very rapid fashion. Just my body was starting to fail me.
And you know what? I know exactly, just from what I see on TV of Japanese wrestling, like I've done some research and watched some matches of the new Japanese wrestling, and they really do these matches that will take a toll on your body. And it's like you said, you are a big guy. You're definitely a big guy. You know, you had a big build and you would do some incredible moves in that ring. And I could definitely see how that could take a toll over time. And, after being back in Japan and rolling the way you've been rolling, when did you finally get that call from Vince? Like, what was it like? And were you basically waiting on that call from Vince, you know, for a while? Or was that something that just came out of the ordinary where Vince McMahon took notice of Del Wilkes?
No, it wasn't like I was sitting around waiting on that call. I had actually had an opportunity to work for Vince before, in the early 90s. I went up and worked, I went out on the road for several weeks with him. Rick Martel got hurt, and they had brought me in for a dark match anyway. You know, sort of, just to see if, you know, cut some promos, let's put them in the can, let's listen to these promos, let's put them in a couple of dark matches, and that turned into, you know, several weeks out on the road filling in for Martel, and I had a chance to go to work there again, but I just didn't feel like the timing was right, and so I was excited about the opportunity. Obviously, you know, the WWF at the time, now WWE, is the grandest stage in all of pro wrestling, but again, I'll be perfectly honest with you, I didn't see it as any bigger stage in all Japan. I didn't see it as, you know, the way I looked at it was I knew this for certain. JR and Jim Ross and Bruce Pritchard were the ones that initially contacted me. I've always had good relationships with those guys, and they contacted me, and Jim Cornette contacted me, and that sort of got the ball rolling. That set up a meeting with Vince. They flew me up to headquarters, and I sat down with Vince and Pritchard and Ross, and we, you know, had a couple-hour meeting, and they offered me a three-year deal, and again, I did the same thing that I did in WCW. I brought it back, had my lawyer look over it. You know, just wanted to make sure I was doing the right thing. Bobby had been very loyal to me, but again, I knew this. I knew my body was failing me, and it was failing me fast. I had blown my knee out. I had to work with a big, heavy brace on my knee, a big, cumbersome brace that sort of affected my movement in the ring. I'd ripped my tricep, literally ripped it off the bone twice, and I had it reattached, and I got back in the ring about 5 months later after surgery to reattach it, and it ripped again. So I knew I was working on borrowed time, and I knew that this was probably the last opportunity for me to come back to the States, work for Vince, and I'll be perfectly honest with you, I had no illusions about me being able to fulfill the terms of that three-year deal. I was such damaged goods that part of the contract that they sent back with me was a form to go to a doctor and have a very thorough physical perform. And there was a doctor that all the boys used back then to get pain meds and sleeping pills and muscle relaxers. And I faxed him the forms. He never even looked at me. He filled them out. He gave me a clean bill of health. And I signed the contract and sent that back to Vince. Because I knew there was no way I could pass a physical with my body being in the shape it was in. And I knew that if Vince knew the condition of my body, he wouldn't hire me. And I was excited about the opportunity. But also, too, there was always something in the back of your mind that just said, you know, this could be the day. This could be the day when it's all over. And eventually, you know, that happened not long after being there.
And, you know, that's just incredible to even hear you talk about it. You know, like you being injured and you being hurt and, you know, you go in there and, you know, you basically wrestle for as long as you can. And, you know, this was the part of your work that I was most familiar with, because I remember being a 9-year-old kid sitting down in front of the TV, you know, watching Raw every Monday night. And I remember this was the time when Bret Hart was getting, you know, real heel heat because he's doing the whole anti-American angle. And, you know, people are wondering, well, who's going to stand up to Bret Hart and defend America? And I have my notes here. Let me pull up here because I have some specific things that I wanted to highlight in WWE. On June 30th, 1997, I see that you defeated Rockabilly, which is Billy Gunn, at a Raw's War event in Des Moines, Iowa, but that was like a, according to this, it was a dark match. It wasn't your TV debut. That your TV debut came 2 weeks later on July 14th, 1997 on Raw with Bret Hart. And I just remember this so clearly, you know, with the whole premise of this feud with Hart being, you know, the anti-American Hart Foundation. And, you know, you were the patriot. You were the one that stood up for America. And I remember clear as day like it was yesterday when you had a singles match with Bret Hart on Raw and you defeated him on July 28th, 1997 on Raw, working with Bret, you know, slowly building this up, and it led to a match on Raw. And of course it led to more, as we'll talk about going forward. But I want to talk about this whole experience on Raw with Bret, you know, just to go in there and to wrestle one of the greatest names in the game and get a win over Bret Hart on Monday Night Raw with the world watching. I remember the crowd was going nuts. They were cheering you on. You started hot out of the gate on Raw, and I'll never forget that moment.
Yeah, it was good timing, because as you mentioned and correctly pointed out, Bret had turned. He was basically the face of the company, and he had turned heel and just was putting the boots to the American citizens and fans in our country, and, you know, just this angry, mad, ticked off Canadian that just hated everything about America. And along comes this flag waving guy that literally drapes himself in the flag and, you know, stands for America and loves the country. And, you know, to pull off a character, it's got to be part of you. And, that was easy for me because I truly do love this country. It's the greatest country ever. And I'm deeply in love with it. And I'm very politically oriented. And so that was easy for me. It was second nature to me to be the patriot, play that character. And the timing of it was perfect to be, you know, to drop in that angle with Vince. I'll never forget. And my meeting with Vince, I mean, to be dropped in that angle with Bret. But in my meeting with Vince, prior to signing, even though I had success in Global, I had success in Japan, I had success in WCW, he just wasn't thoroughly convinced that a mass character could really get over with the WWF fan base. And I just told him that I really thought it could. It had everywhere else I'd been. And I had some good allies in my corner, Jim Cornette and Ross and Pritchard. All, you know, told Vince, they said, hey, look, you know, the guy can do it. And, you know, when Vince saw the reaction that I got, you know, when I walked out to the WWF crowd and in the venues and in the buildings, and I think it was him that he realized, yeah, this can be a good thing, and that's when he paired me up with Bret. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed working with Bret. That was my first time working with Bret. You know, you just look at it as an opportunity to work with another good worker. I spent my career working with great workers, and this was just another opportunity to work with another one that I've never worked with. So,
and I'll tell you, it was such an exciting time in the WWE. It really was. And like I said, I was 9 years old on the edge of my seat as a kid, just enjoying the ride at the time. And when you got that win, I couldn't be happier. I'm like, finally, we got a hero here to save us in the WWE. And I know you moved forward, you know, from that point. And the next thing that I remember so vividly, and, you know, I've watched this match time and time again, was the match at Ground Zero for the WWE Championship, you versus Bret Hart. I know you guys had a whole storyline that you built up, you know, even after the match on Raw took place. And it was just an incredible thing to see. You know, I remember Bret coming to the ring and he was getting the boos because I believe it was in Louisville, Kentucky is where Ground Zero was, I believe.
Correct.
And And I remember the American fans, as soon as your music hit, you came out waving the American flag, and it was just an incredible scene, and the crowd was really, you know, popping for you that night. And I'm sitting at home as, you know, a 9-year-old kid, a fan, just, you know, hanging on to every hope that the Patriot is going to pull this one home and win it for America. And it was just a fantastic match. I was on the edge of my seat as a kid watching this, and I still get on the edge of my seat, you know, even today, just on the WWE Network. It's incredible. It really is an incredible match. And if you could take us through the build and the match itself and how that all came to be, because that was an incredible, incredible matchup.
Well, Brett and I had, you know, tried to, at that point, we'd already worked against each other quite a few times. And so we had spent several weeks on the road, you know, going out to eat together, talking about what we wanted to do that night, and just shooting different ideas off each other. We spent hours on the telephone with each other when we were home and off the road at night. Again, just shooting different ideas, bouncing different ideas off each other about what we wanted to do. And just not only that night, but, you know, down the road with that angle and with that, you know, working with him. And it was funny. It was a unique thing because we're working city after city after city, night after night after night in the States, where I am the baby face and he at that hill that they hated. But then we went all the way across Canada with it, and immediately we went from West Coast to East Coast across Canada with it. And immediately he's the baby face and I'm the heel. Because we're in Canada, and I'll never forget, it's one of the more vivid memories of a match in my career. I don't remember the town we were working. I don't remember the city, but we were in Canada. Of course, we worked the main event every night. And they love Brett up there. As much as the American fans love the Patriot in the States, they love Brett that much in Canada and hated me. I didn't have to do anything but walk through the curtains or come out of a door and they booed me in. But this particular night, I think it was probably the only time in my career that I was concerned for my safety. I'm not exaggerating. There were at least occasions during a 15-minute match, and we had to cut the match short, where fans either attempted to get into the ring or did get into the ring to come after me because of my hatred for me being the Patriot and their love for Brett being the Canadian hero. And we finally just decided right there in the ring that, hey, you know, for my safety, let's get out of here. And so we cut it short. I get back to the locker room, and the police from that local municipality or city, probably about 5 or 6 of them that came into the dressing room, the locker room, concerned for my safety. They said, give us the keys to your rental car. We're going to back your rental car as close to this door as we can. We're going to get you into your rental car. We're going to give you a police escort to your hotel, and we're going to escort you to your room. Now, when you get in your room, and they did, they gave me a police escort to the hotel. They walked me to my room. I had to go through a lobby full of people that were cursing me, screaming at me. They walked me up to my room. And I walked through the door of my hotel room, and one of the cops said to me, he said, we're done here. We've done our job. If you leave this room tonight, you do so at your own expense. My advice to you would be to order room service and get out of here as early in the morning as you can. That's how much they loved him and hated me going across Canada with it. So, you know, 1 week I'm babyface, he's healed. The very next week you've got to turn it around, and I'm healing, he's babyface. So it was a very unique experience. It really was. It was very interesting.
It was something that literally just, you know, crossed borders. You know, it's like when you guys cross borders, it's like crossing into a whole nother world, a whole nother atmosphere. And I'll tell you, you know, I remember seeing Brett, you know, when, on TV, when he would go into Canada, and you're right, he would always get that hero's welcome just like you would here in America. And I'll tell you, when you guys worked at Ground Zero and it was on American soil, you were getting, you know, you were getting a huge pop when it finally got back to the States.
And it was easy working with Brett. Brett literally worked more of that Japanese style than probably any other American or Canadian wrestler. He was snug. I worked the same way. It was a little snug, not stiff, but snug. And it was all very, you know, I never wanted to go into a ring and have a comical moment or a funny moment. It was serious in that. And Brett did too. And not that there's anything wrong with any of that. There's a place for comedy and laughter and stuff like that in wrestling. But I never found a place for it in my matches, and Brett was the same way. So we sort of had the same mindset, and it was an easy deal because working with him was like working. It just felt like working in another somewhat little stiff, you know, style.
And I enjoyed every bit of it. Now, I remember when I was watching this match, you know what, even though the referee called for the bell and, you know, you really showed, you know, your patriotic fighting spirit, when Brett had you in that sharpshooter, you did not tap out. And I remember, I'm like, Patriot didn't tap out. Why is the ref calling for the bell? And then I realized, you know, the referee did that at his own discretion, and You just fought and gave it all your heart, and, you know, showed every bit of your heart, and you left it all in the ring that night with Brett at Ground Zero.
Well, that was important. You know, I mean, that's that fighting American spirit that you want that character to display, and I felt like we were always able to do that.
And you guys did it better than no other. For me, it was my favorite rivalry that you were in. And then I know even past Ground Zero, it even went a little more forward with Bad Blood. And I know it was you and Vader going up against Brett and the British Bulldog in like a flag match. And I remember that was the co-main event of the evening for Bad Blood, when it was the night of the first ever Hell in the Cell match with The Undertaker and Shawn Michaels. So that was a big card that night.
I'll tell you what stands out about that night more than any other thing was I had gotten really, really sick out on the road. And I got home, and I think we had a day or two off, and then we were supposed to be in Minneapolis, if I'm not mistaken. Again, my memory is a little foggy on some of this stuff, but I collapsed at home, and my wife had to call ambulance EMS to come get me, and find out I just got really, really bad dehydrated while I was sick out on the road, and just had to replenish the fluids in my body, and to get me hospitalized over a night, and so I wasn't able to be in Minneapolis or either St. Paul for that show. But we're at the pay-per-view where we've got the flag match with Brett and Davey Boy, and it's me and Leon Vader, Davey Boy and Brett, and whatever venue, whatever building, whatever arena we were in, we're down in the bowels of this building in a meeting room somewhere. We're sitting around a table, and we're trying to come up with a finish, and we're really sort of cutting it short because I think we're only now about two matches away from where we had to go out. And so we're frantically, desperately trying to come up with a finish. And that's when we got a knock on the door. And it was Owen Hart. And he stuck his head in the door. He actually walked into the door and he said, "Guys, I know you're trying to come up with a finish, but I felt like y'all were going to know this." He said, "We just got word that they found Pillman dead in the hotel back in Minneapolis." And that was the night we found out that Brian had passed away. And, you know, for TV and pay-per-views, you were required to be at the building at noon. And, of course, they would cater, you know, food there. And they just wanted you there to get all your interviews cut and get everything worked out. And, you know, everybody, it was just forced Brian. You seen Brian, anybody were Brian. And then, of course, you know, while we're locked up in a room before of us trying to come up with the finishes when Owen walked in and informed us that Dylan had passed away. And it was like, you got to be kidding me. And you know, while you're just crushed that one of your friends and so, you know, one of your brothers has passed away, you've got to put that in the back of your mind and come up with this finish and go out and perform. But you've got to do so with a heavy heart, knowing that you'll never see Brian again. And so it was really an unusual set of circumstances that night.
And I remember that was at the, when you were speaking of where the, you know, where this took place, that was at the, right now it's the same building, but a different name. I know right now, present day, it's called in St. Louis, Missouri. I believe back in that day it was the Kiel Center.
Okay.
And I know that that's where this all took place. And yeah, I remember hearing it too on the pay-per-view when they announced that Brian had passed away, because Brian was supposed to take on Dude Love that night. And I remember Vince had to make the announcement and everything for it, and that was just, you know, a tragedy. And I could only imagine what it had to be like for, you know, not only you, but all of the boys there that had to go out and, you know, with heavy hearts and perform basically in honor of Brian, a fallen brother.
Yeah, it was tough. I had a unique relationship with Brian, and we had known each other before our wrestling days. We actually played against each other in college. He played at the University of Miami of Ohio, and they came to Columbia in 83, and then Brian and I actually played. He was a nose guard, nose tackle, and a heck of a football player. And of course, I was an offensive guard, so we literally battled each other all night that night, and it was the start of a very good friendship and a strong relationship. And so, you know, my experience and my friendship with Brian, you know, exceeded wrestling. It had been built. It started in 1983, so that was a very difficult night.
And you know, if you could give a little bit of insight, you know, about Brian behind the scenes, you know, in WWE. I know he had this character, you know, that was basically unhinged, where they called him the loose cannon. But, you know, from the way you spoke about Brian, you know, right now, and just thinking about probably who Brian really was, he was probably one of the nicest guys you could meet, I could imagine.
Brian was a great guy, but Brian was in a real tough spot, you know, leading up to his untimely death. Brian had battled his whole life. He was a kid that had battled throat cancer and had, golly, dozens of surgeries as just a little boy, a young kid. That's why he had that permanent raspy voice. And then he had injured himself very bad, and he had a Hummer, and he had flipped it, and he crushed his ankle. And he was dealing with just horrible pain, and Brian was really struggling big time prior to him passing away, and it was a struggle that was played out in front of everybody. It was one that we witnessed on a nightly basis, and there were a lot of us that struggled with the same things that Brian struggled with. I mean, I did, probably more have than more haven't. Struggles with prescription medication and pain medication and muscle relaxers and sleeping pills. And Brian was really, really, in order to try to continue to work with an ankle that was just crushed and pinned and plated back together and dealing with excruciating pain. There was also personal issues he was dealing with family. And just a great guy that was going through an awful lot. And really, it was being played out before our eyes. And, it just come to a very tragic end. And, but he was a good friend, a good man. You know, just unfortunate.
Yes, yes, it's definitely sad. And, you know, I still miss seeing Brian perform, you know, even to this day, because he was a great talent in the ring. And, you know, moving forward, when you had to go out there and you had to perform in that tag team matchup, with Vader as your partner against Brett and, the Bulldog, you know, going out there and just, trying to run through the motions of this match. Like, you know, how in the world did everybody get through it that night?
Well, you realize that, you know, you've got to perform. You've got to do what you're paid to do. You're paid an enormous amount of money to do this. It's what you love. There are thousands of people that bought tickets to see this live. There are thousands upon thousands that are at home watching it, and it's your job. And in spite of all the circumstances and all the other things that are going on around you, you've got to put all that aside. You've got to put that, you know, behind you, and you've got to focus on the task at hand, and that's to go out and have this match and entertain the wrestling fans that have paid their hard-earned money to buy the pay-per-view or to buy a ticket. And, you know, you can't let it interfere with that. You've just got to, you know, you've got to go out and do your job.
Yeah, that's 100% right. And, you know, as far as my recollection goes, I believe Bad Blood, that was your final pay-per-view appearance in WWE, because I believe you were supposed to be involved in a Survivor Series tag team elimination match, and then you had the tricep injury, and then you ended up getting replaced by Steve Blackman in that match, if I remember correctly. Now, what I wanted to ask you is, how did everything happen in your last match? Like, how did everything go down in your last match, and is that when you hurt your tricep for the second time?
Oh, no, I never got injured in a WWF ring. As I mentioned earlier, I had a doctor bogus up a physical report, or, you know, paperwork for a physical. Because the injuries I had that ended my career, I came to the WWE with those injuries. I'd blown my knee out in Japan. I'd ripped every ligament and everything into that knee. I've had a total of 6 knee surgeries on it since, with 2 being replacements. I've had that same knee replaced twice. I had the tricep. I think I've had 5 or 6 tricep surgeries since then. So I was damaged goods when I got there. It just got to the point that I could not continue. And it just came to an end on a conference call with my orthopedic surgeon, Fitz and Jim Ross. And, you know, it was just, we all agreed that I couldn't continue. I just couldn't. And the way Fitz left it with me was, Bill, you've got to get healthy. You have got, that's the most important thing, is you've got to get healthy. Take whatever time you need to have these surgeries, get healthy, and then if you want to come back and work a full schedule, you've got a job. If you want to come back and work a limited schedule, you've got a job. But that never happened because of other issues that I was dealing with at the time. Of course, you know, the addiction to the prescription medication that really just set my life spiraling out of control. So, you know, it was left with Vince and Jim Ross that they'll go get healthy, whatever it takes, ever how many surgeries, ever how long you need. And then when you're ready to come back, the door's open. But, I was in no shape to ever go back. And, there were just other things going on as well at the time.
So it sounded like you were going through an awful lot at the time. And, I guess where I want to go with this is, now, like I said, I believe your last pay-per-view, appearance was Bad Blood. That's what I remember. Was that also your last WWF match before you guys, you know, decided that, you know, this was it, you can't continue, or did you have another match?
Yeah, I think I had several other matches. As a matter of fact, I worked with Brian on his very last TV match ever. It was me and Brian. And so I had some other matches, but I do not remember which one was my last match with the WWF.
Okay.
I have no idea which one it was.
Well, I do want to say, Dell, you know, now that you explained, you know, what went down in the WWE. And I'm, you know, I'm sorry if we're going overtime, but this is just such a compelling and such an amazing story. What I want to get into is, you know, your life after the business when you had to take a break and walk away from WWE. And I want to give you the platform now to talk about your experiences and everything that you went through and everything that you had to overcome with the prescription pills, with the, you know, everything that, you know, you were taking and everything that you had to struggle with. I would like to give you the platform to talk to, me and all the fans listening about it because, you know, even to raise awareness with everything. So I'm going to give you the floor to talk about that with us right now if you would like to.
Well, you know, when you're in a business, it's sensible. Every time I hear somebody refer to pro wrestling as fake, I want to slap their teeth out of their head. It's entertainment. There's nothing fake about it. It's men and women that deal with severe injury in a business that they love. And I was introduced to prescription pain medication by Kurt Kenny. I was on the road when I told you earlier about when I was out on the road to the WWF back in the early 90s. And I had an elbow that was just swollen up the size of a softball, and I later had to have surgery. And I just was complaining. It was me, John Nord, and Kurt Kenny in a roller car. And Kurt said, man, what are you doing to be able to work with that elbow? That thing looks awful. I said, well, I'm taking Goody powders. And especially people in the South are very familiar with Goody powders. It's a powder form of aspirin, basically, or acetaminophen. And he goes, you kidding me? I said, yeah, that's what I take. He said, do you not have a doctor that'll write you some prescription pain medication like a Percocet, a Vicodin, a Lorset, Lortab? And I was naive to that stuff. And I thought if you ever took any of that, it would make you dizzy and goofy and unbalanced. And, you know, I said, how do you work on that stuff? I said, did you take it before magic? He said, yeah. I said, how do you work on that? He said, my question is, how do you work without it? He said, you need to get a doctor to write you a script. But in the meantime, here's an insult. And before your match tomorrow, I'd take a couple, about 30 minutes before your match, and tell me you don't feel a difference. And I did. And I took them not to catch a buzz, not to get high, but I took them because I needed to go out and work and do what I was paid handsomely to do, what I love doing, to do what fed my family, paid my mortgage and my car payment, and put my kids through private school and allowed me to live my dream out. That was the only reason. I took them to help me work through an injury. And then you fast forward several years down the road, I've had numerous injuries that have ended my career. But now I'm addicted to this. And those two that I took before a match one night that Kurt Hennig gave me now are 100 to 120 a day.
Wow.
I'm taking 20 pain pills at a time. I'm chewing them up and I'm washing them down. And I'm doing that 5 or 6 times a day. And that's just the pain medication. My career's over. My body is just ripped. It's torn up. It's sore. Let me down. It's felt me. But I've now developed an addiction to these pain pills. And I'm taking 100 to 120 a day. And I'm taking numerous other pills, sleeping pills, muscle relaxers, Somas, Valiums, Halcyons to sleep at night. I'm probably swallowing 200 pills a day with 100 to 120 of them being pain pills. Well, after a while, doctors just aren't going to continue to write those crazy amounts. And I learned how to call the prescription, then how to become the doctor. Doctor's written you, then you've got his name, you've got his DEA number, which is his identification number as a doctor. That doctor I told you about that gimmicked up my physical that was providing all the pills the boys needed, writing prescriptions. I'd been around him numerous times in his office, and I'd heard him call prescriptions in. So I figured I could do this. I can pretend to be a doctor. And I did, and it worked hundreds of times. But also, I got arrested numerous times as well. So this pain pill addiction, these injuries have cost me my career. But now I'm battling this addiction that's costing me even much more. I'm breaking the law. I'm committing felonies every day by calling these prescriptions in, pretending to be the doctor. I'm getting arrested time and time again. I built up about a 7-page rap sheet. And eventually, this serious addiction, it cost me my family. It cost me a lot of my finances. It cost me friendships. And most importantly, it cost me my freedom. After over 25 arrests for doing this, there was finally a judge who said, enough's enough. I'm sending you to prison. And so I ended up serving close to a year in the South Carolina Department of Correction. And I walked out of prison on Valentine's Day of 2003. I went in prison, an addict, a man that had basically lost everything. I lost my family. I've lost the large majority of my finances. But I came out a changed man. And I've not been to a bond hearing since. I've not had to deal with addiction since then. It cost me a lot, but it saved my life going to prison. And it made me a changed man and allowed me to become a normal, law-abiding citizen again. And so I've been through a lot. Most of it self-inflicted. But at the same time, you know, through God's grace and God's mercy and His love and just His enduring love, He granted me another chance in life. And like I said, since 03, I've been able to go through life clean, sober, and as a law-abiding citizen. And my body been through it. I've had 15 surgeries, and I struggle physically today, but I can do so without any reliance on any type of pain medication. And you know what? You know, it's very unfortunate. And about 2 years ago, it was a lazy, slow Sunday afternoon at the Wilkes House, and I gave my wife, Kathy, a yellow legal pad and a pen. I said, Kathy, I want you to write down every name that I give you. She said, what are we doing? I said, I'm going to give you the name of every man and woman who I wrestled with. Our careers crossed paths. We wrestled at the same time. Maybe we didn't wrestle for the same company, but we were active at the same time. I'm going to give you the name of everybody I can think of that's no longer with us. This was about 3 years ago. I came up with 85 names of men and women, good men and women, decent, honorable people that had the same dream I did, but dealt with some of the same problems I did and trying to continue to work through injuries. And they fell victim to that life and that lifestyle. And of the 85 names I gave her, probably only 5 died of what you would consider maybe somewhat normal circumstances, cancer, car wreck. But the overwhelming majority died because of the same thing that I dealt with and same thing Brian Pillman dealt with and the same thing that Kurt Henning and Bobby Duncombe and LaGloria Hall, just good men and women dealt with. And I'm fortunate that I came out alive and that I'm still able to talk about it today and hopefully can help others that are maybe dealing with the same thing. And that was the biggest reason I wanted to do the documentary on my career, is to deal with that issue and just show how it affected my life in such a negative way and what it cost me, but also show, too, that you can't overcome that and that we were able to overcome it and still be able to stand and talk to you today and be a dad and a granddad and a husband and just a normal citizen.
Del, it's an unbelievable story, and wow, I just hear that and, you know, I'm trying to process all that, and you went through so much and overcame so much. And I listen to the number. The number is absolutely just staggering when you said 100 to 120 or no, even upwards. Didn't you say 180 to 200? Total pills a day, and it's like, wow, you are so fortunate, Del. That's a staggering number, and I'm so happy that you're still here with us today to tell this incredible story that you're telling. And
well, I am too. It's just for the mercy of the Lord that he spared my life and allowed me to, you know, come out the other side. So I'm very fortunate.
And you know what? You're here to, you know, to do just that, to, you know, maybe, you know, you're here to help people that are going through the same problem that you went through. And, you know, I want to ask this question just because, you know, I'm curious. I hear of, you know, when people have to go through this and, you know, they try to get off the pills, how hard it is. Like when, like you said, you had to go to prison, and that's when you quit the pills and you came out the other side, you know, and, you know, you were okay after that. Now, when you had to stop doing the pills in prison, how did you get through, you know, just day by day and, you know, day by day and everything that you had to go through to get used to not taking them? Because I could only imagine your body, you know, without having those pills, your body was probably in so much pain.
Well, I was very fortunate in that I had been through court ordered rehab 4 times because of all the arrests from the fraudulent prescriptions. So I was fortunate by the time I went to court and went before the judge and was sentenced to prison, that I had already gotten off the pills. I was fortunate because otherwise it would have been tortured. There's no other drug that your body becomes more physically addictive to than opiates, pain medication, heroin. They come from the same plant. They're an opiate-based drug. And other bodies, you can develop a mental addiction to it, a psychological addiction, but this is a physical addiction. And the dope sickness you go through is unbearable. I've never in my life been intimidated by anything other than that. And I was fortunate by the time I was sentenced to prison, I had gotten off the pills. Now, my life was still out of control, and I was, you know, drinking from sun up to sundown and going through, you know, mounds of cocaine, but I was already off the pills. So at least I had gotten off them before prison or otherwise. It would have been torturous to have to go through, you know, the dope sickness you'd have to go through. It just cold turkey. But, you know, it was tough. It's tough when you lose your freedom and you stand before a judge and you realize that this isn't going to be an overnight stay in a county detention center. This is going to be months and months and months and months locked up behind the wall in a real-life prison and wearing a real-life jumpsuit with, you know, the South Carolina Department of Corrections written across the back of it. It's sobering. And I knew when I got in prison, I said, okay, there's one or two things I can do here. I can make the most of this and allow this to change my life. Or I can get out and continue doing the same thing. And if I continue doing the same thing, one of two things will happen to me. I'll either be dead or I'll end up right back here in prison. And I made my mind up that I didn't want either of those two options. So I'm fortunate that, you know, I am alive and I can talk about my story.
And you know what? You sound like you're in a great place right now. And you know, now's where we could get in, you know, to the good stuff. You know, once you got out and got out of prison and you got sober, you know, what was next in your life, you know, to get you in that positive upswing, you know, that you're in right now?
Well, I did not, and I've been away from the business for so many years that, you know, that wasn't even an option for me. I've always been a guy that likes to work. I enjoy working. I enjoy staying busy. And I had a friend of mine that's been very well in the car business. And he set up an interview with me at one of the bigger dealerships in Columbia. And I was very upfront with the people. Of course, I mean, they knew who I was. I've got pretty good name recognition throughout the state of South Carolina. And but I was upfront with them about, you know, man, I'm not about 3 days removed from prison and just looking to rebuild my life and start over. a very good 12-year career now in automobile sales. It's been very good to me. I've done very well with it. Also, too, I'm still very involved in wrestling. I was able to get connected with the business again in making personal appearances and being able to get back around the fans and do a lot of the fan fest type of events. And, matter of fact, last week I was in Winston-Salem for WrestleGate. The week before that I was in New York for WrestleFest. So I do a ton of those type of events throughout the course of the year. I also have the opportunity to give my testimony to youth groups, to churches, to business functions. So I get the opportunity to be very busy, stay very busy in life, and a lot of it hopefully is helping others. We've got our website that we've had for several years now where I sell my merchandising, masks, pictures, t-shirts. I think probably the most important thing I sell off there is my DDD. It's my life story. It's my career. It's Behind the Mask, Belt, Patriot, Wilkes. It's a free disc set. It's over 7 hours. And it's my life from beginning to end, and the good, the bad, the football, the wrestling. And I was very fortunate that several of the guys I played football with took part in it, and they're on there, including George Rogers, the 1980 Heisman Trophy winner, and then many guys in the wrestling business, Bagwell, Stan Hansen, Bill Apter, Bruce Pritchard, just many of the guys that I wrestled with are also on the documentary as well. So I think it's great. I've had nothing but great response from it. A lot of people said that it was helpful to them in time of need, people that were dealing with some of the same issues I was dealing with. So we're very, very thankful that we've got that out there that people can buy and purchase. And it's not about making money. We make minimal money off of it. It's but the opportunity to share my story with maybe people that aren't wrestling fans, just casual sports fans, football fans, just maybe people that aren't football or wrestling fans. But you can say, look, man, this was my life. This is what I experienced. This is what I went through. And maybe this DVD will be of help to you. And so that's what we're doing today. Staying busy and enjoying kids and grandkids and just enjoying life.
And I want to give you a plug here on your website. Tell everybody where they can find your DVD and all of your great merchandise that you're selling today.
www.DellThePatriotWilkes.com, and that's D-E-L, Dell, ThePatriotWilkes.com. And like I said earlier, mask, pictures, football cards, wrestling cards, pictures, t-shirts, DVDs, all autographed. It's very simple. Instructions on there on shipping and how you can get our items. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at Dell Wilkes, and also too on Facebook at Dell Wilkes and Dell the Patriot Wilkes official fan page. So I've got to give a lot of credit to my wife Kathy, who got me involved with social media, and also Steve Austin, who taught me the importance of Twitter. When we were first coming out with our DVD, I was talking to Steve, and he said, I'm gonna tell you what. He said, you need to use Twitter, you need to use Facebook, and get involved with these things, to help get your name back out there, and help get your merchandising out there. So, I'm as ignorant as it comes when it comes to technology and social media, but with Kathy and Steve's help, I was able to get hooked up on Twitter and hooked up on Facebook and become a part of social media today.
You know, that's so great, you know, that you're out there, you're on social media, you're promoting the website, you got all this great stuff going on. And, you know, if you could just see me right now, I'm just sitting here with the biggest smile on my face, because after everything you went through, and you got to rise above it all, and you overcame it all, and you're in a real good place right now, as it sounds, and you also got to live both of your dreams, and you know what? it's like we talked about in the beginning, you know, not many people even get to live one of their dreams. It's like you got to do it all in your life, and it's really, really an incredible story.
Well, I appreciate it. It's been an incredible life. It's been an adventurous life. It's certainly not been dull, but I've been very blessed to be able to do what I wanted to do and what I had dreamed of doing as a kid. And to be here today and to be clean and sober and got a 9-month-old granddaughter, got another granddaughter that'll be here in February. And it's just wonderful. I tell you, I'm very fortunate. Got a wonderful wife. Kathy's been a godsend. I love her deeply. And it's just, things are good.
Well, I guess the last on-air question that I'll have for you, Mr. Wilkes, would be, after everything, you know, after everything you've gone through, the journey that you went through, and, you know, even where you're at today, what's next for you? Do you have any specific plans in the future, or is it all about just living one day at a time?
No, it truly is living one day at a time. We're not promised anything. Matter of fact, in church today, our pastor was preaching on that. And you know, it doesn't matter if you're young, old, in good health, in bad health. You know, you're just one breath away from eternity. And so it's about living one day at a time. And I want to continue to do what I do. I love being around the wrestling fans, and I love the opportunity to get around them and to attend these events where you can see them and also be around the guys that I spent so many years on the road with. And also to be able to share my testimony with others and also to just enjoy my family. And it's amazing not only to watch my granddaughter as she grows and develops, but I spent all day today with my daughter and my granddaughter and just watching my daughter develop as a wife and as a mother. And that's it. That's what life's all about, is family. And just sharing those moments and cherishing those moments with your family and with your friends. And it couldn't be any better, and we're just very thankful.
It's absolutely beautiful, Del. Well, I do gotta say, you know, in closing here, with everything and, you know, like I said, everything you've gone through and, you know, now your message with your whole story and, you know, your website and your DVD, it seems like it's spreading out such a positive message, you know, to help people. And I do gotta say, the Lord definitely had a purpose for your life. And that's why you're still here with us, Mr. Wilkes, to help people.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate his goodness to me and giving me another opportunity in life. And I thank you for having me on and allowing me to share my story with you and your listeners. Enjoy it. Always cherish any opportunity I have where I can share my story and the redemptive end of it, how there can be life after falling flat on your face. You know, you can get up and dust yourself off and just keep working and keep moving straight ahead.
That's right. That's the best way to live your life. And I couldn't agree with you more. If you can, Mr. Wilkes, please hang on the line with me, you know, while I sign off here to the live audience. So just, hang on the line with me for a couple minutes. If you have any last words or any last messages that you'd like to give to the fans before I, on the air, feel free to do it now. If you'd have one last thing that you'd like to say.
Well, I just want to say thank you to the wrestling fans. They're unlike any other fan base. You know, I played football. Football has been such a big part of my life, and what a loyal base of fans we have here at the University of South Carolina. But wrestling fans are unlike any other. It's amazing last weekend in Winston-Salem and the weekend before that. And New York, no matter where I go, wrestling fans can come up to you and they can tell you about things in your career that maybe you have forgotten, but they remember. They remember those special nights and those special matches. And I say thank you to wrestling fans everywhere, because without them, there would never be me. There'd never be any of us that's ever spent 1 minute in this business. If there wasn't the fanfare, then there'd be no need for us. So I say thank you to each and every one of them. You're a special group of people.
And I want to say back to you, Del Wilkes, as far as, you know, myself being a fan, and I'm sure I speak, you know, for a lot of other fans out there. Thank you from all of us for putting your body on the line for the sake of our entertainment, for sacrificing everything that you sacrificed, sacrificing your body, sacrificing your health, sacrificing time away from your family, just so that fans like me and everyone else out there can buy a ticket to a show, to go sit in a seat and to be entertained. And for all that, and for all the sacrifices, and for all the sacrifices that you've made, and, you know, just for the sake of our entertainment, I say thank you, Mr. Wilkes.
Well, I appreciate that, and I would gladly do it all again.
And you know what? Hopefully, one time down the line, I will be lucky enough and fortunate enough to maybe meet you face-to-face one day. But hang on the line with me, Mr. Wilkes. I'm going to sign out for the live audience, and just hang on with me here, and I'll be right back with you. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard Mr. Wilkes. This is I have to say, as being a broadcaster, broadcasting on here for nearly 3 years, this interview with Mr. Wilkes is hands down the greatest interview that I've ever done. And I just even want to say to Mr. Wilkes, you know, right here, because I know I still have him on the line, but I also want to say to him, thank you for giving somebody like me the opportunity to live my dream, because this is my dream to do broadcasting and to, you know, get a chance to talk with, you know, other people in the business and do broadcasting and have a show like this, because I love the business so much. And to have one of my childhood heroes, Mr. Wilkes, which is you, because I watched you as a child, and to have you on the show. And I'm living my dream right now. I can't tell you how much this means. What an honor and a privilege that this is. And again, I say thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for tuning in. And I'll be back with you next week for episode number 35 of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed this. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Podomatic and all that good stuff. And to hear this great interview with Del Wilkes, make sure you subscribe to the podcast right now. And again, I want to say a big thank you to Mr. Wilkes. And ladies and gentlemen, we will see you next week for episode number 35. And thank you very much, everybody. You have a great night, and good night, everybody. And one more thank you to Mr. Del Wilkes. Good night, ladies and gentlemen.